The Andy Pollin Show on ESPN 630 starts right now.
All right, you may know my philosophy on jerseys, that after the age of 40, it's really schmucky to be seen in a jersey. However, if you follow me on Twitter, at AndyPollin1, you will see a picture of me wearing a jersey today. This is a special occasion. On Sunday, they are going to retire Sonny Jurgensen's number 9. He was a boyhood hero when I was growing up, watching games at the lunch table in high school. I was debating Sonny versus Billy. That was a big part of the legacy here, and that he and Billy Kilmer going back and forth in the 73-74 seasons, and I was always a Sonny guy in those debates. So I feel something special about this, and a great thrill in my career getting to work with Sonny. That was fabulous, and for him to know me is it's just tremendous, and he is going to be rightfully so honored on Sunday when the Commanders take on the Dallas Cowboys. That even sounds funny to say, Commanders take on the Cowboys, because, you know, Sonny in many ways is Washington Redskins football. In fact, he did retire before the start of the 2019 season. I was going to say he carried it right to the end of the last year that they were the Redskins, but no, he had left at the beginning of that season. But from 1964 through 2018, he was so much associated with the team that, you know, they were synonymous. Sonny, great quarterback, Hall of Fame quarterback for 11 years. And then after retirement, going into the booth with Sam Huff and Frank Herzog and doing the games right here on this radio station, AM 63, for all those years. They went to another station, our station that we started in 1992, AM 570, and that became 980, and then they left, and they went to, I guess they even left before. I think we decided not to renew even before the move from 570 to 980. They were on JFK for a while, and now Bram Weinstein does the games, and he does them on DC 101. Is it DC 101? No. What's the station, Rex?
100.3.
Oh, Big 100. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's where he does the game. So that's a big thing for me coming up on Sunday. I want to say I wish I could be there, but I, you know, going to the game with all those Cowboy fans and yeah, it's FedEx Field, which is okay to go to, but you know, it's just not going to be the same. And my friend Tom Lavero wrote a good column about the relationship between Sonny Jurgensen and Billy Kilmer today. He contacted Kilmer. As a matter of fact, when Tom put this out on Twitter a month and a half ago, that he had contacted Kilmer to talk about Sonny in preparation to do this column today, Kilmer said he hadn't been invited. And then that got out on social media, and the team put out a statement. Oh, no, we're going to take care of that. Don't worry. Well, kind of short notice, but in Tom talking to Kilmer here, Kilmer says, quote, I sure will be there. And they even sent a camera crew there to his Florida home to interview him. I guess they're going to have a video tribute with some comments from Kilmer about Sonny. It was a unique relationship and continues to be a unique relationship. Two guys who competed for a job becoming best friends. And there have even been a couple of instances like the two of them showed up at a Nats game together a few years ago. So it's really something to look back on the legacy of Sonny and to see his number retired, as it should be. It should have been years ago, but it's going to happen on Sunday afternoon when the Commanders play the Dallas Cowboys. All right, I want to get to the schedule stuff. It impacts the Ravens. It impacts the two teams that played or should have played on Monday night. And fortunately, the news on Daron Hamlin is good, that he is going to be, they think, getting out of the hospital soon. And that it does not appear to be any neurological damage. As the doctor said, the lights are on, and he seems to be home, which is great. Great, great news. But the league now is adjusting, and they have decided that they're not going to even deal with this game anymore. It's a non-contest. It's not going to be played, and they'll do some, and we'll get into what Adam Schefter said about that in just a minute. I wanted to talk about this Maryland game last night. I'm a big Maryland basketball fan, always have been. And I was really excited. December 2nd, it was a home game against Illinois. Illinois was ranked higher than the Terps, or the Terps may not have even been ranked yet. And Maryland won. They played very well. They beat Illinois 71-66. It was a very good crowd at Xfinity Center. And you go, oh, season looks good here. And they had a couple of big wins earlier in the year, blowout wins. They beat St. Louis, a good team, 95-67. Miami's a very good team. They blew them out 88-70. And you thought, okay, this is going to be a fun year. And it may still turn out to be one, but it hasn't been much fun lately. After that, they went to Wisconsin. Wisconsin's a tough place to play, and they're a very good defensive team, but they held them to 59 points, Wisconsin winning by five. Then they play this neutral site game in Brooklyn against Tennessee, fall way behind, do make a run at the end, had a chance to win, but they lost, and they only scored 53 points. They lost 56-53. There's a lot of hype for this UCLA home game. I hadn't played UCLA in College Park in like 40 years, and they were terrible. The final score really doesn't tell the story. UCLA won by 27, 87-60. A lot of those points for Maryland were in garbage time. They had no offense in that game. Then last Sunday, they played at Michigan. That was really awful. They lost that one 81-46. 46 points. And again, many of those points in garbage time when the backups are playing. And so last night they go to Rutgers. Rutgers is a very good team. And Rutgers is coming off a win over number one Purdue. You wonder about a letdown in that. They obviously didn't have it. If you watch the game, they're very good defensively, but they're not a great offensive team. And though Maryland scored only 17 points in the first half, Rutgers only had 24. So it wasn't like it was over at that point. And then Maryland made a nice little run in the second half and I think got to within four. But then it was Rutgers all the way, the rest of the way, as they won 64-50. Maryland from the field, 19 of 46. They missed their first 10 threes for the game. They were 8 of 22 from three. And the veterans are just not scoring for them. Adonte Scott, who was a very good three-point shooter at the beginning of the season, not now. He finished with only 6 points. Akeem Hart with 2 points. So these are guys that they were depending on greatly. Julian Reese, who's had some shoulder issues, he had foul trouble last night, but relatively speaking, had a fairly decent game. He had 6 points and or 8 points and 6 rebounds in limited time on the floor because of the foul trouble. But it does not look good. They got Ohio State coming in on Sunday. Kevin Willard after the game said that he was happy with the way that they had responded, like a dead effort against Michigan, and thought that they had a good effort. And if you watch the game, it did appear that they were playing with intensity. The problem is Rutgers is just suffocated them defensively. And Willard even went so far as to say this, that the reason that things have been bad lately is because they've been playing on the road. But now they're going to be playing at home against Ohio State with some more home games coming up, and that's why he's feeling optimistic.
You know, they're working hard. They're getting good looks. They're good offensive players. This is the first time these guys have gone through this. So, you know, being on the road, battling tough crowds. I think that's what's great about this league is every night there's been a great crowd. You know, sometimes schedule dictates how you play. I know Jerry hates that quote, but sometimes schedule dictates how you play. And right now we've had 3 tough games on the road. We've played well at home. We just haven't been home that much. So I have the utmost confidence in these guys. I will get it going offensively again. I'm not so worried.
Not so worried. You can put that in bold letters. The UCLA game he seems to be forgetting about. That was played at home, and that was no contest. UCLA winning that game by 27 points. It'd be nice to see them turn things around. It's a disaster, complete disaster for Georgetown. And the warning shot has already been fired at Patrick Ewing by the athletic director, Lee Reed, the other day. So I think that it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that this is going to be it for Patrick Ewing at Georgetown. But you'd like to see Maryland. I'd like to see him be in a position to compete for the NCAA tournament. But what looked like a certainty at the beginning of the year is looking pretty shaky right now after some really ugly losses. And without much offense, I really don't know. Because they're not deep. They don't really have a lot of guys that they can bring in who can score. The game that was supposed to be played the other night, it's a no contest. So that means that they're going to have to do some things to try and even out the competitive balance as we get into the playoffs. The one thing about that game was that both teams are in the playoffs. Both Buffalo and Cincinnati are in. The question is about seeding. It really would have been difficult to get this thing straightened out if both teams were competing for the playoffs. But the fact that they're in leaves them with some options, though somewhat cockamamie options. This was Adam Schefter explaining how it sets up on ESPN.
If the Chiefs beat the Raiders on Saturday and the Bills beat the Patriots on Sunday, the Chiefs would get the bye, but there would be the possibility if those two teams were to meet in the AFC Championship game under that scenario, where that game then would be played on a neutral site. So the Chiefs would hold on to the bye, but lose the home conference championship game. If the Chiefs lose to the Raiders on Saturday and the Bills beat the Patriots on Sunday, the Bills are the number one seed. They get the bye, and they obviously would get the home playoff game in Orchard Park.
Okay. Kansas City's not going to lose. They're not going to lose to the Raiders on Sunday or Saturday. That's just not going to happen. In fact, they are 9.5-point favorites on the road at Vegas. Josh McDaniels may even be one and done. This may be the last game that he coaches for Vegas. So I don't think that happens. And likely you will see Buffalo win their game against New England. That's a home game in Buffalo, and it's going to be very emotional. And, you know, there's two ways you can look at this. You could say, well, you know, the team is rocked by this. And if you saw any of the incredible news conference yesterday that the Bills had, Sean McDermott, very emotional when he spoke. Josh Allen, the same thing. And he said, you know, we could be affected by this for life. But I would compare this to what happened with Sean Taylor when he was killed in 2007. Now, the first game that they played was a home game against Buffalo, and had a chance to win that. Joe Gibbs, unfortunately, called back-to-back timeouts at the end of the game, shortening up what turned out to be a relatively easy game-winning field goal attempt by Buffalo in the final seconds. If he had not called the second timeout, I believe it would have been a 51-yarder and not a sure thing. But they lost that game. They flew on Monday to Miami for Sean Taylor's funeral and had to play a game on Thursday night against the Chicago Bears. Jason Campbell got hurt in that game. Todd Collins came in, won, and they won their last four games of the season and made it to the playoffs. Buffalo is a much better team than that team was, and they're already in the playoffs. But I don't know. I mean, who knows? I mean, I'm speculating here. I'm just making the comparison that you would think that Washington would be incredibly devastated by that. And Buffalo, fortunately, has gotten very good news on Hamlin, and they are cruising into the playoffs right now. They're one of the best teams in football, so I don't think it's going to affect him, which means that the likelihood is we're going to have a championship game, if it gets to that, on a neutral field, which I think is not good. I really don't think that that's fair, not fair to the Kansas City Chiefs. I understand why they have to do it. I know they have to even things out, but it just seems like, you know, that is not fair to the fan base of the Kansas City Chiefs. Yes. Now, if Buffalo plays it out and they have the same record, Kansas City lost to Buffalo, so Buffalo would get the home field and the bye and all that. But I just think that neutral site games, except for the Super Bowl, don't make a lot of sense. But I guess they had to do something. And the pushback, and we're going to hear from the Ravens later on. We'll get Ravens preview coming up, as we do every Friday. The Ravens are in a position too where they're affected by this, because they now have no chance to win the AFC North. Had Cincinnati lost the other night to Buffalo, then they would have had an opportunity to win the division on Sunday. That's out the window, but at least publicly they're not making a big stink about that. Couple of things from the news conferences, final news conferences of the coordinators yesterday for Washington. Jack Del Rio, who you might say going into the season was embattled to some degree, that the defense was not as good last year as some thought it should be. This year, much better, and they've gotten some really good play out of the defensive line. Del Rio asked to assess what he saw from his defense this year.
A lot of good things. I really appreciate, respect, love the guys, the effort, the commitment to this organization, preparing hard every week, going out and giving us what they have each week, sticking together, you know, through adversity and things. I think it's been outstanding. I think there's been a lot of real positives. So ultimately, as a team, you know, we wanted more out of this year, but I'm proud of the effort that the guys gave.
He was also asked about his job security, and he says he's not worried about that. Says, actually, he'd like to be a head coach again if that opportunity comes, but he loves coaching football and would like to stay. It'd be interesting to see what happens with Ron Rivera in the offseason. If Dan Snyder doesn't unload the team, like, real fast, I think it's almost certain he comes back. I don't think he unloads Del Rio, though there might be pressure from new ownership coming in to see. I don't know. I don't know how that's going to work out. Scott Turner, pretty much in the same boat, asked about the disappointment this season not making the playoffs.
I feel good about, you know, some of the young guys that we have on this team. I feel like there's been some moments where, you know, we've really looked like we're going to turn a corner. You know, we didn't do the things that we wanted to do this year. I mean, no one's going to sit here and say that. I'm accountable for that as much as anybody. I think this group can really grow. You look at the youth around here, obviously, you know, Terry, and then, you know, we came out of that San Francisco game a couple weeks ago. Our leading receiver and our leading rusher were both rookies, you know. So you look at the guys that we have, I think that there's a lot of room to grow. And, you know, I look forward to working with these guys and continue to get better and keep improving and get this team where we want it to be.
Do you personally worry about job security or anything like that?
I mean, that's just part of this league, you know. It could happen. It could happen to anybody. You know, it's happened to guys when they don't expect it. It's happened, you know, whatever. So I just do my job. I'm focused on the Cowboys. Whatever happens, you know, after this week, you know, you go with it after that. But to me, I'm prepared to coach this game and then get this team ready to go be successful down the road.
Nobody understands better about coaches getting fired when it's not expected, like his dad, coaching the then Redskins at 7-6 and in position to make the playoffs, and fired after a game against the Giants when the young owner thought the team could get a spark by going to Terry Rubisky, and they were embarrassed the next 2 weeks by the Cowboys and the Pittsburgh Steelers and knocked out of the playoffs. Be somewhat ironic if Scott Turner also gets fired by Dan Snyder. Isn't that something that to think about? Yeah, I think at times the offenses look very good this year, and I think he's done a good job. But he is subject to criticism, and you see a lot of things on the message boards, people just crushing him. I think that's a little unfair. But that would be something if father-son firing. I'm sure it's happened before, but two Turners out the door from Dan Snyder. Young Dan Snyder and then old Dan Snyder. Young Turner, previously old Turner. Tom Friend grew up in Washington, covered the team for the Washington Post, and I believe the Washington Times, has had a long career in media, working as a writer and as an author and producing television. He's going to join me next, and he's a guy who's old enough to remember Sonny. So we're going to talk about the career of Sonny as they get ready to retire his number on Sunday. Tom Friend next. It's the Andy Pollin Show, ESPN 630.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
Named one of the best personal finance podcasts, The Stacking Benjamin Show with Joe and his friends makes financial literacy fun.
Work hard and save your money. That way, when you're old like me, you can buy the things that only young people can enjoy.
Squirrel watching.
You heard it here first. Get yourself a squirrel cam. Spend $30 a month on nuts, and you'll be at early retirement before you know it.
No, Piggy, this is the road to a podcast nobody listens to.
Find out more by searching The Stacking Benjamins podcast wherever you listen.
The Andy Pollin Show on ESPN 630, the sports capital.
Tony's coming up at 11 o'clock, and I would expect Tony to have some things to say about Sonny Jurgensen. They've become friends over the years. Tony wasn't here when Sonny was playing, but working in television, the two have gotten to know each other a little bit. And I would expect that he will have a little bit of a tribute to Sonny, whose number is going to be retired on Sunday. Tom Friend is a local, grew up in Washington, and has had a long career in media as a sports writer, as an author, as a producer, television, 20 years with ESPN, did some reporting there, and is good enough to get up early in California to join us this morning. Good morning, Tom. How are you?
Good morning, Andy. What's going on?
Well, I'm just I'm sitting here, and I'm 64 years old, and I think it's schmucky to wear a jersey once you pass 40, but I am wearing my Sonny throwback this morning because of that's the way I felt about him, both as a player and a broadcaster. This is special for me. What does it feel like for you seeing his number retired?
So funny you say that about the jersey. I have one hanging in my closet. I was going to If the Redskin game, well, excuse me, I called the wrong name. If it, Washington had had a big game Sunday against the Cowboys, but it meant everything, maybe I would have broken it out and worn it while I watched the game. But this is sentimental for me. Anybody who grew up in the era that we grew up in D.C., there was Sonny and there was Frank being Frank Howard for the Washington Senators. And those two people were hanging up on my wall, their posters, and I had the bumper sticker, "I root for Washington and I like Sonny." That became huge in 1972 when Billy Kilmer was there as well. And I just feel like it makes me almost emotional to talk about him because he was D.C. There wasn't a team that you could say, okay, we're going to go to the playoffs or we're going to do this or that. But 1967, the Green Bay Packers win the Super Bowl, and Johnny Unitas is the league MVP, but Sonny Jurgensen threw for more yards, more touchdowns than anybody. He was Dan Marino before Dan Marino. There wasn't a ball he didn't feel like he could fit in somewhere, which is why he also threw a ton of interceptions, a little bit of Brett Favre in him. So to me, he was bigger than, larger than life. You know, he was at Pall Mall. He was at Dancing Crab. He always knew he was out late the night before. He had the gut until Vince Lombardi showed up. He was a Duke quarterback. You couldn't believe there was a quarterback from Duke who was
right
doing this. He was everything. And for me, Andy, I'll end on that note. The fact it's 2023 and they're doing this is absurd. They should have done this in the 80s when Jack Kent Cook was the owner. So let's not say it's all Snyder. Cook should have done it. I can't believe his number wasn't retired before. You know, when I covered the Redskins for the Post, I knew there were numbers that retired. You know, number 9 was unavailable. Number 42 was unavailable. Number 43 was unavailable. And so they just should have done it.
Yeah,
that's all I can say.
No, they had a policy where the only officially retired number was Sammy Baugh's 33. And this was okay because Jay Bernetti was the equipment guy, and he'd been there forever, and he knew the history, and he didn't give out the numbers. Well, Bernetti's gone by 2002. Steve Spurrier shows up, and he's got his boys, Danny Werfel and Shane Matthews from Florida, and they want to wear their college numbers. Well, Matthews wore 9 at Florida, and Werfel wore 7. And they show up on the practice field, and longtime reporters go, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, what is this?" And word got out. In fact, you may have heard this story, that Matthews still wanted to wear 9, and he called Sonny, and Sonny said, "Well, it's okay with me if you wear it, but the fan base isn't going to like it. It's probably not in your best interest to do it." So he wore number 6.
Sonny wasn't okay with it. That's the funny thing, because, you know, Theismann went along with it when Dwayne Haskins wore number 7. But Sonny wasn't afraid to say no. You know, I love that about Sonny. When you got to know him, he was going to say whatever he wanted to say. And you know, I think back also to those years, Andy, is that, you know, he called his own play. This wasn't a situation where he's getting plays sent in, shuttled in by, or singled in by Joe Gibbs or something like that. You know, he's going to call the play. And for anybody who says he didn't win, he would have won in 72.
Yeah.
That team in 72, you know, when he took over, he was on fire. The two greatest games that I ever saw him play was a Miami Dolphins game in 74 where they're playing the defending champs at RFK. It's a beautiful 66-degree day in the middle of October. And, you know, I'm sitting there in my – you know, I was fortunate enough to have season tickets, and, you know, he's down with a minute and 50 left on his own 20, and he goes 80 yards for the score with a touchdown to Larry Smith. And, you know, back in this day, that doesn't – a minute 56 isn't much, but in the NFL in those days, the way defenses played, the way receivers could be bumped, it was a big accomplishment. And then in 72, which I mentioned, there was a game against the Cowboys where they're down 20-7. The Cowboys were defending champs, and Johnny had thrown three picks that day, or a few picks that day. They were down 27. He came back, and, you know, they won 24-20, and he just was brilliant. And but, you know, he would have – 72 was the year that they would have won the Super Bowl. In my opinion, they would have beaten the Dolphins if Sonny plays.
Yeah, I mean,
and even Shula said
– Shula said that, and you may have heard this as well, that, you know, Shula had a restaurant, the first of the steakhouses was called The Undefeated. And as the story goes, Sonny's sitting in there, and he looks around at all the pictures of the players, and he says, you know, if I'd have been healthy that day, this place wouldn't be here. so there's that.
I just think that this city doesn't – there's a fan base of this team that doesn't understand it. You know, I don't think they really realize what he meant to this town. They weren't winning. They didn't have a defense. They didn't have a running game. And all it was in those days as a kid, you want to go to RFK to see – it was DC Stadium then. You want to go see Frank Howard hit a home run and Sonny throw a spiral. That was the two things in your life that made it glorious.
Yeah, no question. Yep.
And that was it.
Yeah. We were talking to Tom Friend, a longtime writer, author, producer in television, and like me, grew up in Washington. His family, lucky enough to have season tickets. Once in a while, we'd buy from a scalper or somebody in my father's office would give us a pair. But it was great to go there and watch Sonny. And like you, you know, the Sonny that people remember from the Billy versus Sonny days was sporadic because he was hurt a lot. And Billy was hurt, too. And that's sort of why they alternated playing. But if you go back to the pre-George Allen days, Sonny didn't get hurt. And what you're talking about are teams that didn't have defenses, and he would throw a bunch of touchdown passes, and they would lose the game. And, you know, same thing with Frank Howard. There was an era where Washington teams were bad, and the old saying, first in war, first in peace, last of the American League, that fit. But those two guys, you know, gave us something to hold on to. Those were our superstars, right?
Right. I mean, that was it. And, you know, it's funny, the offense was, when they had, you know, defense just go to sleep because it was going to be bad. But when the offense took the field, you had Jerry Smith, who arguably should be in the Hall of Fame. His numbers are incredible for a tight end. You had Bobby Mitchell and you had Charlie Taylor. So they were just throwing the ball all over the place, and they didn't have a running game. When Larry Brown showed up in 69, things changed, obviously, with Vince Lombardi. But the scores weren't great. You know, they didn't win a lot. There was one year where they tied three times. You know, they had three ties in one year. People talk about this year, they almost tied the Giants twice. So they had three ties one year with him. But imagine if they had overtime. he could throw the ball behind his back as well as he could throw it regular. I mean, as a kid, you tried to throw like him. I sat there. I was a quarterback of my little elementary school team, and I'm throwing like Sonny. I'm trying to. So it was just an era of you lost, but you had a thrill. And I just feel like the comps, you know, now are, it's hard to quantify, you know, what he would be like today. But the thing about that era, Andy, is that there was a song, Sonny, by Bobby Hebb.
Yep.
And it corresponded, it came out, I think, in 66, and it corresponded with Sonny's era in Washington. I think I just thought as a little kid that, oh my gosh, they have a song written about him, you know, and it wasn't written about him. It was Sonny's S-U-N-N-Y. But it really, really played. If you go listen to the words, it was, you know, you put sunshine in our day. That was Sonny, you know, and that song was on, you know, everywhere in that city in that time.
Yeah, it's, you know, you wonder about quarterbacks who wind up in the right places. And clearly, Tom Brady winding up with Bill Belichick in New England was the perfect storm. You know, Sonny had a whole bunch of different coaches, and the one coach that he really loved, sadly, he had, as you mentioned, with Lombardi 1 year because Lombardi died of cancer. You know, you wonder if he would have wound up in a place with a coach, not at that level, but close to it, you know, what kind of career he would have and how many Super Bowls he might have won or how many championships he might have won during his 18-year career.
Yeah, I never thought Sonny respected his coaches until Lombardi. You hear him talk about Otto Graham. Otto Graham wasn't a great coach.
No.
You know, he talked about Bill. You know, Bill McPeak, you know, was an offensive guy, but, you know, that was a coach before Otto Graham, but they didn't win. And I don't think Sonny was glad to throw the ball around, but, you know, I don't know if he thought he was much of a coach. He finally gets a coach in Lombardi, and you see he gets in shape, And, you know, it was a whole different ball of wax. But then, you know, you have to understand he was in 72 when they make their run, he's 38 years old. And you're right, the injuries just piled up and the interceptions piled up at the end. I mean, mm-hmm. there was a huge game in 74, his last year in the NFL. He beats the Cowboys. They come back. They play the Cardinals, who were a surprising team that year. And he threw like a pick. Roger Worley takes it back to the house. And then his last game as an NFL player against the Rams in the playoffs, they put him in there to try to save the day. And he throws a pick to Isaiah Robinson, takes it back to the house. So, you know, he wasn't afraid to fit balls in. And if he'd ever had that kind of coach or that kind of defense early in his career, there'd be a whole different narrative. I don't think people realize. I saw someone on Twitter say that he was just a guy. You know, no, he wasn't just a guy. And that's the famous line, did you ever see him play? And you had to see it.
Yeah.
The way he could spin it. The spin rate, if they measured it back then, would have been insane.
By the way, isn't it something? I'm sure you can't remember too many details of a game you watched last week, but you're spilling out statistics from games like 50 years ago. Doesn't that show you the passion? And I think it's instructive for people listening who have no memory of this. I mean, you have to be probably close to 60 years old to remember seeing him play. And when you're a kid, like you know, the Super Bowl in 73, I was 14 years old. It took me a whole week to get over that, you know? And
I'm not over it. Yeah. I'm not over it. The ball hit the goalpost. Come on.
Yeah.
That was Philly was terrible that day. And let's not get into that. But yeah. Anyway, I think you're right. And, you know, I think there's a passion of our fan base for the real history. The people that like us who grew up in the glory days, I feel like it's hard for the younger generation to kind of get it. I feel like they're bitter. I don't blame them. This team is so frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why I keep coming around and sitting here and paying what I pay for the Sunday ticket and I don't miss a game and I write a blog, Skins Forever, I just, it's because of what I witnessed as a child, mm-hmm. you know? And I just don't think that it can be quantified. You know, I still have my Sonny jersey, like you said, like you do. It's just a different time. And I think there's something about being a lovable loser, and that's what Washington was in those days. And when we did finally win in the early 70s, it made it even more special. And that's why I feel for this fan base when they finally win, when things work out, I assume at some point,
right,
will be a turnaround. And it's going to feel really well. But you know, I don't blame them because you know I don't know much about Sammy Ball. I mean, I didn't see him. My father talks about Sammy Ball.
Me too. Yeah, mine too. He saw him play, but I'm too young for that, fortunately. But yeah, there's that. The years that you were the beat writer for the team, what years did you cover them?
I covered. I was partnered with Christine Brennan in '87 mm-hmm. as a beat writer in '87 when they win the Super Bowl in San Diego with Doug Williams and Jay Schrader. The whole
I was there
quarterback
for that.
Controversy there. And then I was a solo person on the beat in '88 and '89.
Okay, so what I'd ask you is as you've just expressed all this passion, what was it like as a beat writer when the team was good? How did that feel?
I'll tell you a great story. I got the job, and obviously when I was at the LA Times, and I get the job to cover the Redskins for the Washington Post. It's your dream job. I had been a Washington Post copy boy as a college kid, and just to be there was. It was a dream. You know, you're 27 years old, 26 years old, and you've got this job. I go in there the first day, and Phyllis was the secretary there who was at the PR office, and she's really nice. But Dexter Manley came up and started saying, "Who are you?" and she goes, "He's from the Washington Post." And someone said, "Well, you shouldn't talk to him then." Because the Post relationship with the Redskins wasn't great at that time. And at that point, it sort of sobered me that I'm a fan of this team, but no more.
Yeah.
So while I covered the Redskins for the Post, I the fan part of me went away. It took me until like the Norv years really before I was passionate again. I'd say from 87 to 93, I was kind of not a little detached because when you cover the team, it's different, Andy. You know everybody. You see all the warts and the flaws
and the
personalities. It's totally different.
It's the old sausage analogy. If you love sausage, you don't want to see how it's made. That's true. But I would think one of the side benefits, and I was able to experience this with radio because we did some shows together and will remain with me as one of the great thrills of my life. You got to know Sonny a little bit as a person, right? And I wonder what that was like for you, having been such a fan and going to games and like me, you know, growing up rooting for him as a kind of a boyhood idol.
I tried not to get on my knees and bow down to him when I first saw him. I managed not to do that. But the cigar he was you knew he was coming because the cigar was you know, entrenched in his mouth. I just went up to him one day. I just said, you know, hey, I grew up here and was a skin, you know, Skins fan, and you know, hey, you know, it was amazing. Thank you. And that was it. One time, and it was a little awkward, you know, and that was it. He knew I was a fan, but you know, he was great to hear him talk about football. You always knew he was tuned in whenever anything was going on. But you have to understand, in those days, Andy, that team was so good that, you know, there wasn't really the drama that goes on now wasn't going on back then. I think that, although there were a couple of years, I think 88 was a rough year. But, you know, Sonny, you would pick his brain. You know, if there was a story to be written about certain things of the passing game or certain things of the offense, you could always go to Sonny and get perspective. And he was a really, really great guy. And that's, that made it even better, the fact that you could go to him and talk. And I met Frank Howard the same way, and Frank Howard's a gem. You know, so your two boyhood idols were really great men, and it made it even more special.
Yeah.
And, you know, Frank Herzog and Sam Huff, they were all great guys. I mean, that was just a...
Well, they were the soundtrack of the Camelot years. I mean, you go to nine years and four Super Bowls, win three. You can't do much better than that. And those were the days when you could actually, technology allowed you to do it a lot easier than now. You could turn down the sound on your TV and listen to them, and many people did, because you could, if you wanted to go to RFK. Stuff to get in, 55,000 seats, and most of them were season tickets, and there's, you know, no tickets available. So, you know, that was the soundtrack of all those great years, don't you think?
Yeah, no one's allowed to say touchdown Washington Redskins. That's Frank Herzog.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I don't know. It you know, he was great. He was great. He, you know, he was the Bullets guy before that. He was tremendous at that.
Yeah.
You know, it was just you know, it was. I don't know if young guys today can understand it. There was a sense that you would outcoach your way to victories in that era. You know, with Gibbs and they, at halftime. Oh well, Joe's going to make adjustments at halftime, and
Richie,
the team's going to win the game.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen anymore. I think that's the biggest indictment of the Ron Rivera era. Is I just don't feel like they outcoached anybody. And so that was part of it, but. Sonny was that constant there. And it was interesting because a lot of his old teammates were in the organization. You know, Bobby Mitchell was part of the organization. Charlie Taylor was an assistant coach.
Mm-hmm.
There were guys around that from that team, those teams that were there.
Yeah. Well, as Bob Hope once said, thanks for the memories. And I know you're out on the West Coast, but you got the ticket, so good. You'll be tuned in on Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, I wouldn't miss it. I mean, it's a shame what the game means, but I hope Sonny's going to be okay. And the thing that bothers me most, and I know you got to go, but I will say this: the fact that there's going to be 80% Cowboys, the fans there, he's not going to get his due. And
I know.
And that's what really bums me out.
I know. That's. I wish this would have happened at a game that meant something, and there'd be more fans. But frankly, they're really not drawing fans anyway. I mean, no matter what, even when they, you know, this past game against Cleveland, when they had still had a shot, they had 50,000 people on a beautiful day. So it ain't what it was.
And the reason why it's depressing is that Alex Ovechkin, if he had a day like this, he would be lauded. Imagine if Sonny had a day like this in the late 70s. He's bigger than Alex Ovechkin is, and that's not even close.
Yeah.
Not even close.
No question. Hey, God, Tom, thanks very much. Plug your blog again. What the name of the blog that you write every week?
SkinsForever.com.
SkinsForever.com. Thanks. I'll talk to you soon.
All the best.
You too. That's Tom Friend, who, you know, you hear that, and as he's rattling off what happened, play-by-play action from games 50 years ago and more, that's what passion is. And if you grew up here and you rooted for those teams during those years, as I did, yeah, it's a big thing to see Sonny's number retired. The organization didn't do it for a long time, and it started to happen really, and they're reactive to these sort of things. But, you know, after they had disgracefully given out Bobby Mitchell's number 49 in 2002, when they realized their mistake in giving out 7 and 9, he left the organization, and he said that was the final insult. And then when George Floyd was murdered, they decided that they would be sensitive, and they retired Bobby Mitchell's 49, which should have been done many years ago. Sean Taylor's number was retired, and there are some who would debate, you know, how soon that should have happened, but that number is retired. And now Sonny becomes the fourth number to be retired by the organization. not too late. Fortunately, he's still around and will be there, and Billy Kilmer will be there, though Frank Herzog, as I understand, was not invited to this, which is, you know, how they do things. They, if there's a way to screw it up, they do it. But Sonny will be honored by however many fans are there, and I hope that all the Cowboy fans that are going to be there will at least appreciate him and give him his due as number nine is retired on Sunday. Coming up, 25 years ago today, Barry Switzer resigned as coach of the Dallas Cowboys, and they have wandered in the desert ever since. We'll get to that next. It's the Andy Pollin Show, ESPN 630.
Former Navy SEAL Sean Ryan shares real stories from real people from all walks of life on the Sean Ryan Show.
Comedian John Crist.
How long have you been in Nashville?
Let's see, 2018 is when I moved here. I lived in an apartment. I didn't know anything about it. I lived in L.A.
You were living in L.A.? How was that?
Yeah. Let's see. Good for my career. Send me to rehab, though. So that's pretty much the sum of it.
The Sean Ryan Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.
Yesterday,
the Andy Pollin Show on ESPN 630, the sports capital.
Nice job, young man. Rex Minturn. Very creative. We just had Tom Friend on. Tom Friend, longtime writer, covered the then Redskins for the Washington Post. He worked for ESPN for 20 years. He's with Sports Business Journal, and he writes a blog about the team. We reminisced about Sonny Jurgensen, and he talked about this song, which came out when Sonny was at his peak in the late 60s with Washington. Came here in 1964, traded for Norm Snead. And the team was bad. It was bad because of residuals from being a racist organization until 1962 when they finally integrated. And it took a long time to rebuild. And Sonny was the thing that we held on to because he was an incredible passer. If you ever saw Sonny throw a spiral, it was a work of art. It was beautiful, his pass. Dan Marino-like. And the comparisons between the two of them, I think, are apt. The Marino got to one Super Bowl, lost. Sonny never played in a Super Bowl because he was hurt the year that they made it and actually never started a playoff game for Washington. There were fewer playoffs in those days, harder to make it, but never started one. He finished his last game. His last game that he ever played was a playoff game against the Rams, and he was brought in for an ineffective Billy Kilmer and finished with a pick six. Game was, you know, pretty much over then anyway. It wasn't like, you know, that pick six cost him the game. But that was how it ended for him. He was 40 years old, and that year he had led the league in passing percentage. Isn't that incredible? 40 years old, top passing percentage on legs that were pretty much shot. He'd had a lot of injuries during his career. Coming up at 10:30, as we always do on Friday, we've got Ravens preview. I'll talk to Cliff Brown of Ravens.com. If you're not up to speed on all these different scenarios now that they've decided that the game between the Bills and the Bengals is off, it's a no contest. It's like it was never played, and they'll use percentages to figure things out. A couple of tweets from Adam Schefter last night. If the Chiefs lose Saturday and the Bills win, I don't think the Chiefs are going to lose. They're heavily favored against the Raiders, and the Bills, I think, will win against the Patriots. But if that happens, the Bills would be the number one seed, and then all this stuff goes away. But if they both win, what they're talking about, if they meet in the AFC Championship, they'll play it at a neutral site. Also, for the Ravens have no shot now to win the AFC North. Cincinnati clinches that. But if Baltimore wins on Sunday at Cincinnati, it's a 1 o'clock kickoff and coverage here will start at 12:30. If they play a wild card game against each other, which could happen in the first round, a site for that game would be determined by a coin toss. So that's how that would work out. If because even though they wouldn't win the division based on percentage, if the Ravens win on Sunday in Cincinnati, because of the extenuating circumstances and the bat being taken out of their hand, essentially, to win it, because Cincinnati, had they lost on Monday, this would be a chance to win the division, that they would have a coin flip. So they'd have at least a chance to host a wild card game if it comes down to that. And all this has to be voted on today, by the way. So it's not a certainty, but this is what's being proposed, and the owners will take a vote on that later today. Coming up, hour two, we'll get into more on the situation with the Commanders as they close out the season with nothing to play for. View Tony coming up at 11. Don't go away.
Former Navy SEAL Sean Ryan shares real stories from real people from all walks of life on The Sean Ryan Show. Comedian John Crist.
How long have you been in Nashville? Let's see, 2018 is when I moved here. I lived in an apartment. I didn't know anything about it. I lived in L.A.
You were living in L.A.? How was that?
Yeah. Let's see. Good for my career. Sent me to rehab, though, so that's pretty much the sum of it.
The Sean Ryan Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.
The Andy Pollack Show on ESPN 630 starts right now.
Actually starts at 9 every day. We go till 11 every day, and sometimes we go till noon. No, not today. Tony's got a show coming up at 11. And I'll be interested to see if he says anything about Sonny Jurgensen, whose number is going to be retired Sunday at FedEx Field. Sonny is an icon in this town. I mean, unfortunately, he played his last game almost 50 years ago, 48 years ago in December. And there aren't many of us who remember him playing. You know, you'd have to be probably at least 60 years old to remember that. Most people remember him as a broadcaster. And he was on this radio station for most of his run, started in 1981, retired after the 74 season from playing, became an analyst for CBS, and was one of their top football analysts. In fact, Ernie Bauer, my friend, longtime television director, told me a story that there was actual discussion about having Sonny become part of the number one team, which at that time was Tom Brookshire and Pat Summerall. Summerall later, of course, teamed up with John Madden, the most legendary play-by-play duo ever. But before Madden came along, Madden, I think, was still coaching at that time or just getting his feet wet in broadcasting, it was Summerall and Brookshire, and they did the number one game every week. And there was discussion that they were going to bring Sonny into the booth, this third man, because Monday Night Football was off the ground, and they had a three-man booth, and the thinking was that CBS should do the same thing. And as Ernie has told me, Sonny was waiting in a room to find out about this, and was told, "No, sorry, we're just going to go with Tom." So, you know, things might have changed, and that might have become a big trio for many, many years on CBS, but it didn't happen that way. And Sonny's contract ended, I believe, after the 80 season with CBS and was not renewed, and wound up with his friend Andy Ockershausen, who ran this radio station for many years. And Andy said, "Let's put you in the booth with Sam and Frank." And magic happened. They were great, and the team became great. It was like the perfect storm. And so most people, younger people, I say younger than me, which is just about everybody, remember Sonny as a broadcaster. But I remember him as a player and as a broadcaster. Frank Herzog was on another station today, and I'd heard this yesterday, and he confirmed it himself. Frank was not invited to this Jersey retirement ceremony. Again, whatever this organization does, they find a way to botch it, particularly these things. There's no way you should have a number retirement ceremony for Sonny without Frank. Yes, you could say Sonny wasn't wearing a number when he did the games, but he forever is number 9. People knew him as much as a broadcaster and as a player, and his partner for most of that run was Sonny Jurgens, was Frank Herzog. And Sonny, Sam, and Frank was the soundtrack of the great years, the Camelot years of this team. And just, whoever is in charge of it. Now, my friend Tom Lavero did a column today. I'm going to read you a couple of things from it where he talked to Billy Kilmer. He had contacted Kilmer like 5-6 weeks ago about this, about talking about Sonny as he got ready to write a column for this particular day in front of the retirement. And at that time, Billy said he had not been invited. Tom put this out on Twitter. Word got back to the team. They said, "Oh, don't worry, we're gonna invite everybody." Well, it's a little late at that point to be inviting, but they got it done with Kilmer. Did not get it done with Frank, which is just ridiculous. Just ridiculous. But they did get to Kilmer. He is going to be there. And as he told Tom, he said, "I sure will be there." He's 83 years old. The Commanders also made arrangements for Kilmer to be part of the ceremonies, and they sent a crew to his home in Florida to interview him. So they did it right, finally. Maybe shamed into it, but I guess whatever intern was in charge of putting this together, maybe had never heard of Billy. Certainly never heard of Frank, I guess, because Frank's not invited. And Kilmer talked about the incredible relationship between the two of them. Now, this really engulfed the town. It really did. The I Like Sonny, I Like Billy bumper stickers. It was just great. I mean, people talked about it all the time, and you'd drive around the Beltway and you'd see these bumper stickers. And I played some of this yesterday. Sonny told a story that he and Billy used to drive around together on the Beltway, and they'd see a car. And Sonny said if he saw a car that said I Like Billy on the bumper sticker, he'd flip the bird, and Billy would do the same thing if he saw an I Like Sonny sticker. Pretty funny. But their relationship was really odd in that, you know, they were competing for jobs. They were both, you know, somewhat in the prime of their career. But Sonny was a legend here. He was established. And Kilmer really wasn't thrilled about coming here because he knew Sonny was the man. He didn't want to be a backup. He was traded by the Saints because they had taken Archie Manning with the second overall pick. But as Kilmer told Tom in the story, he says, I've been in the league for 10 years and had never been on a winning football team, and Sonny hadn't been on one in Washington except for that 1 year with Lombardi. Between us, we knew this team was going to be a winning team. He wanted to play. I wanted to play. There's no doubt about it. If I got benched, it hurt me inside, but I didn't show it and tried to help him if he needed help with some things. He was the other way, too. When I was in there, he always helped me. We socialized together, and that meant a lot to the team seeing that. Everybody got along. Teams can't be splintered. We didn't want that to happen. They've remained lifelong friends. There's also the Theismann factor in this. And I think to this day, Sonny and Billy still call him Theismann. In 1974, which was Sonny's last year in the league, the then Redskins under George Allen made the trade for Joe Theismann. He had been drafted by the Miami Dolphins. And Theismann looked at the Dolphins and they said, well, they've got Bob Greasy. I'm not going to play there. He went to play in Canada. Played for 3 years, and George Allen wanted him because he had these two old quarterbacks, and he traded a first-round pick to the Dolphins to get him, and the rights for Theismann came here. In 74, there was a player's strike, a veteran strike. Well, Theismann wasn't a veteran. He was technically a rookie, even though he'd been out of Notre Dame for 3 years, but hadn't played in the NFL. So they had games that went on. They had exhibition games with just rookies and free agents, guys who were not in the union. And Theismann had a pretty decent game in one of the exhibitions, and he said to reporters after the game, he said, well, you know, I'm going to try and play here and keep those two old men on the bench. And as Kilmer told me, he saw that story in the paper. He calls up Sonny. He says, do you see this? Sonny goes, yeah. He says, you know what? I don't care which one of us plays as long as he doesn't. And that's the way it worked out, that Theismann didn't play, actually returned punts because he just wanted to do something. And Sonny and Billy were back and forth for that last year in 1974. And then Sonny retired at the end of the season. And then it was left with Kilmer and Theismann. Though they did have a quarterback named Randy Johnson who they brought in. And he actually beat out Theismann for the backup job. So Theismann remained third string for another year. He didn't really cement himself as a starter, I think, until like 78. I think 78 was the first year that he really took over, and then took the team into the early glory years under Joe Gibbs. But, you know, as you look at this and you think about Sonny and what he did as a player, his unfortunately for him, his best years were with teams that weren't as good. And when he finally had a defense, when George Allen got here, he wasn't healthy enough to stay on the field. And George didn't like him. He didn't like him at all. He was a guy who, as I think Tom put it pretty well here, he called offense a necessary evil. I think that's something that we should look at. And I think that's something that if you look at the relationship between the two of them, that the two, they were oil and water, basically. That George just wanted to run the ball, keep the defense off the field long enough to get a break, and then put him back on. I just was sent this tweet from Ian Rappaport. He says, this is amazing. For the first time, Damar Hamlin is addressing the team via FaceTime. The breathing tube is out. He spent the morning speaking to various teammates on FaceTime. Now he's delivering a message to the entire group. Thank God. Thank God. So, you know, I don't know if he's ever going to play football again, but here it is, Friday. He was hurt on Monday, and this is as miraculous as you can get, I think, that some and all credit to the medical staff for getting to him as quickly as they did to save his life. And that is, wow, that's some great news. And I think everybody can breathe a sigh of relief and move on to football. And we'll talk more about this with Cliff Brown of Ravens.com, how this is going to be handled. It's quite possible, because the Ravens can no longer win the division, that they might face Cincinnati next week in a wild card game. And we won't know until after the games are completed on Sunday where the game is going to be played. That the latest is, and the owners have to vote on this, but the latest is there would be a coin flip whether the Ravens or the Bengals would host the game. I think it's dependent, though, on the Ravens beating the Bengals Sunday. I think that's it. They can't win the division if they beat the Bengals, but if they beat the Bengals, they would have a coin flip to decide where it's going to be played. And Greg Roman, the offensive coordinator, had a couple of things to say about that scenario if they are to play them again in the wild card game and how that might change things. And we'll get to that coming up shortly. Let me get a couple more things in from the Commanders. This was Scott Turner, offensive coordinator, reaction yesterday. The coordinators always talk on Thursday. Reaction to Sam Howell getting the start on Sunday.
I felt really good about Sam. You know, he's had multiple roles as far as, you know, he started out this year as an inactive third, was the backup for a while, where he was preparing to play. And, you know, he was one play away from playing, you know, for however many games that was, you know, when Carson was inactive. And, you know, I felt good. Like, if he would have had to play, you know, I would have felt comfortable with him playing. I'm excited to see him go out there and play. You know, obviously not a great situation as far as just, you know, what happened last week and everything like that. But, you know, he's excited. He's worked really hard for this opportunity, and it's going to be good for him to get out there and play.
Whatever happens will only just be the one start. So for going forward for him, what's the realistic expectation for you in terms of what he could be next year and beyond?
You know, I don't know. I think it's too early to say that. I think you just, you know, you evaluate him. We've already evaluated him throughout the course of this entire season, and we feel really good about that. And then, you know, this is just another part of the evaluation, him out there playing against a good defense.
Okay. So, again, they're not going to be able to tell a whole lot. And the circumstances are really rough because he may not have either of his running backs. They put Antonio Gibson on injured reserve. Brian Robinson didn't practice yesterday. They had 8 starters out of practice. And even if guys are healthy, they want to look at younger guys anyway. So I don't really know what kind of an evaluation they're going to get, but they'll get a look at him. And I think it made perfect sense to play him. Now, the start, that's something else. I'll get to that in a second. This is Jack Del Rio. And, you know, Jack Del Rio started this year under a real cloud. I thought he should have been fired when he referred to the January 6th insurrection. By the way, a happy anniversary anniversary of that today, when he called that a dust-up, when he was schmoozing it up with reporters and he thought he could say whatever the hell he wanted to say, and talking about the protests that went on in the George Floyd murder and how businesses were destroyed and homes were burned and so forth, and nobody made a big deal of that. And all we had was this little dust-up at the Capitol. He was later fined $100,000 for that, shut off his Twitter account, and that was that. And, you know, the season has gone on, and, you know, no real controversy around him. He was asked about the Hamilton situation from Monday night, and somewhat ironic, I thought, by what he said. This was Jack Del Rio talking about it yesterday.
I thought it was a beautiful thing to watch. This is the NFL experience that I've had. Men of different backgrounds, different races, different religions, all that stuff seems to be recently a lot of emphasis on separating us. And I saw everybody coming together and everybody offering support, everybody showing love and respect for each other. I saw a huge group of people holding hands and praying together. And to me, that's the best. To me, our country, our world can see more of that because that's the best in humanity. And to me, that's what I know about the league. And so when I hear about other things, I'm not saying there aren't some things that can be done better, made better, but that's what I know. You know, I have a lot of good people that I've played with over the years, coached with over the years, different backgrounds. different races, and it doesn't matter. These are brothers. These are it's a brotherhood. These are people that I love and respect, and so that's what I took out of it. Now, obviously, praying for the young man, and I've heard good news, and continuing to hear good news. So that's great, and we'll continue to pray and support him and his family.
Okay, so that was well put. I mean, that was quite eloquent from Jack Del Rio, and in quite contrast to what he said in the off season about the dust up at the Capitol. So that was good to hear yesterday. Again, if you're just jumping in your car, tweeted out by Ian Rappaport of the NFL Network that DeMar Hamlin was addressing the team via FaceTime today. And that they've taken out the breathing tube, and he's talked to various teammates, and sounds like, you know, that you talk about the rocket booster that they're going to need to play New England this week. That's it. You know, when you see someone who you saw die on the field and his life was hanging in the balance for days, and if you watched any of the emotional news conference that the Bills had yesterday, whew, that is the greatest thing that you could possibly see. That here's Dion Hamilton as close to what he was at 8 o'clock on Monday night, now getting closer to maybe being 100% and maybe someday playing football again. That's that the doctors have not ruled that out. That is in play. This was yesterday on the Dan Patrick Show. We didn't talk a lot about this yesterday because, frankly, I really wasn't aware of it. It came from a tweet from Jeremy Fowler of ESPN. And he said that Taylor Heinicke was in line to start this week against Dallas, that the coaching staff had decided that. And I thought that that was the way that they were going to go, that, you know, that's it with Wentz. He's done. I'm surprised they didn't even cut him this week, but he will be cut. He's gone. So Heinicke would start, and they would allow Sam Howell to get his feet wet, you know, play him in certain situations, but not necessarily lay the whole thing on him and have him start the game. And what Fowler wrote in the tweet is that that was the plan until Heinicke went to the coaching staff and said, I think the kid deserves to start. Why don't you give him the whole thing? Why don't you allow him to start the game and play the game? And this was Dan Patrick yesterday talking to Mark Sanchez, who was once a number one pick, finished his career here disgracefully. He was part of the parade of quarterbacks that they had here in 2018 after Alex Smith got hurt, but now is a very good analyst. Good-looking guy, too. Boy. He's an analyst with Fox, and he was on with Dan Patrick yesterday, and Patrick asked this question.
Trying to understand what's going on with the Commanders. They're not going to make the playoffs. Taylor Heinicke was going to start against Dallas, and then the report was he went to the coaching staff and said Sam Howell should get a chance. I mean, Taylor Heinicke...
But you told them that?
Yeah. Mixed reports, but that's from ESPN that he said, hey, why don't we give Sam a chance here? He hadn't played all year long. Taylor Heinicke is a free agent. I didn't know if this was akin to sitting out a bowl game here where... You know, let Sam play. I'm okay with that. Or is that just Taylor Heinicke's personality where he's like, I would never want to give somebody a shot. If I didn't have security, I would want to continue to play.
Maybe he knows he'd be there in some capacity. I don't know. Because he's an excellent guy. They've given him a chance to start for a long period of time. I don't know Taylor personally. His story is incredible. We've called a couple of his games. I've talked to him on just like this on Zoom a couple times, and I've loved him. But me personally, I don't know if he's wanting to continue to play in this league, which I'm assuming he is by the way he plays and the passion he shows. I'm a little shocked by that.
I'd have a hard time doing it.
I would too. I would too. Absolutely. And that's, you know, no slight on Sam Howell, but hey, dude, there's only one of us that gets to play. It ain't like running backs that rotate and receivers and tight ends and all that. It's a different position. And I don't know. I mean, maybe he knows, you know.
I don't
something
know.
We don't know.
Well, what we know, those of us who are close to the team living around here, we know that it's a constant state of chaos. So, you know, I think Heinicke looked at it this way. And not everybody has reacted, by the way, like they did. I'm kind of leaning towards what what they said about you never give up your spot. You know, it's hard to become a quarterback in the NFL. You let somebody else play. So you get pipped. Somebody else comes in, does his job. They never hear from you again. It's kind of a unique situation. And people looked at this around town. I saw some of the reports, not reports, but some of the reaction from people who said, oh, you know, he's such a great guy. He's a generous guy. Now, I think there's more to it. Rex Minturn, much younger than I am. What do you think of this? If a guy has a chance to be a starter, he's only started, 20 games or something, 25 games in the NFL.
Yeah.
What do you think of him saying, let him have my job here?
Two things. One, he's about to get the biggest payday of his life. Mm-hmm. So why subject yourself to an injury with no running game, a terrible offensive line, and Micah Parsons coming to town?
Right.
Two, is it really that appealing to be offered? Yeah, you can start, but we're going to yank you at some point. It's not like he would get to finish the game.
That's true. That's true. Here's the way I look at this, in his situation being somewhat unique with this team. He knows if he's coming back here, it's as a backup, that they're going to have somebody else in here. And if he does get hurt in the offseason, then that's going to decrease his chances of signing with somebody else.
Right.
So he's looking at this like, I didn't play last week. If I don't play in this game, then I can go into the offseason healthy. And when I get looks from other teams, I'll have that. Plus, what I have on tape is not bad, you know. And people know who he is. He does not have a great arm, but he's the perfect backup. And so he's going to have teams bidding on him to be the backup. Does he want to be the backup here? Who knows? But I don't think it hurts his chances. I think he realizes this hurts his chances of coming back here if he doesn't play. And this also may tie into what's been happening in college football with these bowl games in recent years, that you have guys who know they're going to be high draft picks, and if you're not competing for the national championship, you opt out. And it doesn't seem to hurt your draft stock.
Yeah. So, I mean, Heineke, I don't think he's come from such a different background than that. I don't know. And it's not like you're getting he's not going to be able to get the win. Sanchez said, it's not like running back, only one of us gets to play. They literally said, no, both of you are going to play.
Right. Right.
So it's not really.
I think he meant
apples to apples.
I think he meant in winning the job. If you're a running back, you can share the position. You can't really share the position of quarterback. But it's a unique circumstance because at this team, now there may be some team out there who looks at Taylor Heineke and says, "Yeah, we can win with him. We'll make him the starting quarterback next year. We'll draft somebody, and when he's ready to play, we'll play him." That could happen, but I think most teams realize the limitations that he has, and I think he knows his own limitations. So I, in this circumstance, I don't think it's that big of a thing, but it sort of breaks one of those longtime tenets. You never, never, ever let somebody have your job. You know, there's talk about Tom Brady in practice, wouldn't let anybody else have any reps, you know, things like that.
It's also another notch on his belt as being such a great locker room guy.
Yeah, yeah, but there's also that mentality in football. Oh, you never surrender. You never say, hey, let somebody else step in there.
Unless you're the back. That's the perfect backup is the guy
right.
who
it
would
is.
Do that.
It is, you know, and I don't think anybody would doubt his competitiveness. So, you know, I think his resume is out there. I don't think it's that big of a deal. And I think if you listen to Sanchez, he's not saying, dude, what are you doing? He sort of said, okay, maybe he gets it. And yeah, I think you have to really understand how this organization works too. It's so screwy. He's been here long enough to know how things work. And maybe he had a discussion with the coaches to that degree to say, look, I really don't want to give up my job. I've worked hard to do this, and I appreciate this, but. Here are my circumstances. Here are your circumstances. And you probably want to get a look at this guy. You drafted him. You haven't played him all year. There's also this school of thought, too. You know, when Heineke was playing and Wentz was hurt and out on injured reserve, remember all the discussion about why isn't Heineke running more?
Yeah.
Could have been because they know this guy can't play. And that could be part of it, too. That could be like, oh, you want to see him play? Go ahead and start him. Yeah, see what you got there. You know, there could be somewhat of that. I know he doesn't know the offense. I'm watching him. I know he doesn't know what he's doing. So go ahead. You want to play him? Go start him. And I'll be there. I'll be ready to go in case you need me. That could be that. One other quick thing. We got Ravens preview coming up. Nate Colbert has passed away at the age of 76. Spent most of his career with the San Diego Padres, hit 163 home runs with the team from 1969 to 74. That's the most homers in franchise history, by the way. Also became the second player in Major League history to hit five homers during a doubleheader. Also rang up 13 runs batted in that game against the Braves. But the local for me on Nate Colbert is this. The years he played in San Diego, 1969 to 1974. When the Washington Senators left here, after the 71 season, it looked like the Padres were coming here. And not for 72, but for 73. And Topps baseball cards put out a few players from the Padres that said Washington National League. They didn't have room to fit in National, so it was, so they like an apostrophe, N-A-T, apostrophe L, League. And I remember the Nate Colbert card, and they had like blacked out on his hat the SD. And it just had, you know, him in a uniform, brown uniform that they wore, that he was going to be one of our players. So, you know, I started looking at who was on the roster. And they had, you know, Willie McCovey was playing there then. They had some, Randy Jones was a good pitcher. And so I was excited. So Nate Colbert, when I was a kid, hoping for a baseball team to come back here, little did I know it was going to be a 33-year wait. But when it looked like it was only going to be 2 years, I thought, oh, wow, Nate Colbert playing at RFK Stadium. We're going to have National League Baseball here. Whoopee! And, of course, if you know the story, there was a lease issue, and the Padres didn't want to buy it out. Joseph Danzanski, who owned Giant Food, was in line to buy the team, but the lease held them up. Ray Kroc, who owned McDonald's, bought the team. They stayed in San Diego. And they're still there. They're still there. Fortunately, we have our own team. Not a very good team now, but we got a team that's won a World Series, and the Padres have not. So there's that. But we had to do 33 years without a baseball team, which wasn't good. But anyway, rest in peace, Nate Colbert, passing away at the age of 76. Thanks to earlier in the show, Tom Friend, longtime reporter and a writer and author and a producer, to talk about Sonny. Enjoyed doing that. Thanks to Rex Minturn for running the show. Enjoy the weekend, and I will see you back here Monday morning at 9 a.m.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.